communication were definitely deficient. There were other issues such as supplies being lacking, including medications, equipment, surgical supplies, and there were definitely challenges for staffing as well. But I was writing to my husband from northern Nigeria as these events were unfolding that I shared with you, and he suggested that we might be able to tackle three of them: reliable electricity, light, and communication. And so I returned to Berkeley, and together we designed a system that would help the hospital and formed an organization. It's called We Care Solar, which actually stands for Women's Emergency Communication and Reliable Electricity. And my husband's idea was to design four standalone solar electric systems that would be targeting maternal health care. And so he wanted to provide solar power for the operating room, the maternity ward, the labor room, and also the laboratory so we could bring in a solar-powered blood bank refrigerator. Each of these had a similar design using solar panels to capture electricity that was stored in batteries for use during times at night and in times where electricity was needed. Before going to install this type of a system, we thought it would be important to discuss our ideas with our Nigerian colleagues. And in fact, I asked Hal if he could please make a demonstration kit where I could bring things like the high-efficiency LED lights we were hoping to use for surgery and walkie-talkies that we hoped the doctors would use to improve communication for surgeries. And I asked if he could make a kit small enough that I could literally fit it inside my suitcase, in part to help me get through customs in those days. And this is a photo of me actually opening the suitcase and sharing it with a couple of doctors that were in northern Nigeria. And not only did they like the demonstration kit, but they said, could you leave this here? And at first I said, no, this is just a demonstration kit. There's a much larger system coming. We actually are fundraising, but that will be here within several months. But they said, this could help us right now. And so one of the surgical technicians, Aminu, convinced me that he would guard this equipment with his life. And so the solar suitcase was born. And he began using the LED lights in the surgical suite. The walkie-talkies were then used to assemble a medical team within minutes. Headlamps were used to help nurses when they were setting IVs. And over the next few months, the hospital was literally transformed. And one of the things we realized was that a very small amount of power was enough to light a surgical suite. In this particular photograph, there's a 5-watt bulb that's actually enough for physicians to conduct surgery with very good illumination using the LED technology. Well, we did continue fundraising and came back in 2009 to install the large system. And there was a transformation that occurred. The maternity went from being the sea of darkness I spoke to you about to an island of light. And the operating room, which was often dormant at night, was now able to function very well with only 15 watts of power using four small LED bulbs for ambient light and a surgical light over the surgical table. We also put in a blood bank refrigerator. And together, these interventions helped change the culture of the hospital. Hospital workers were very motivated to work at night. They no longer feared their jobs. And the hospital went from having between 3 and 8 deaths a month to less than 2 and sometimes 0 deaths. In fact, the maternal mortality in the hospital went down by 70%. Meanwhile, the hospital was actually admitting more patients because they no longer had to close the door at night because of a lack of power. So the capacity to see patients went up by 16%. And to be very honest with all of you, Hal and I thought we were done. Our goal was to help one hospital. But that wasn't what some of the Nigerians had in mind. In fact, people in the hospital began talking to clinicians in clinics surrounding the big hospital, and soon we were asked to bring our little solar electric kit to surrounding facilities. And so we brought one first to a clinic close by called Tudunwada Clinic. Then we were invited to bring a solar suitcase to the Millennial Village in Pampeda. And so we began to intentionally make these suitcase-sized systems. Well, I would have thought that we would be done at that point. But we actually received some attention from Nicholas Kristof from the New York Times, unbeknownst to us. He wrote a blog, and the following day we started getting requests from around the world. And so we realized at that moment that we had really touched a rather important nerve, that there were healthcare facilities around the world suffering from energy poverty and health providers trying to do their job without even basic lighting. And so we began to send off additional solar suitcases. At this time, they were mostly assembled by Hal and a group of volunteers. And we sent it to places that we had never been. For example, in Burma, there was a group of midwives trained in Thailand who literally put the suitcases on their backs and walked into the jungle to set up makeshift clinics so they could start delivering women at night. And after the earthquake in Haiti, we got requests for solar suitcases to be used by medical providers who were trying to set up clinical care in tents that, of course, did not have an electricity supply of their own. Well, the story keeps going. I'd like to talk about where we're at right now. So in the next few minutes, I'll be talking about what we've been doing for the last year and where we think we're headed. So at this point, much of our energy is in trying to really improve the design of solar suitcases and create a product that can be manufactured, not just by my husband in a kitchen, but actually in a vac factory to try and respond to the demand that we are seeing from around the world. We feel a very important part of this design is working with people who are using these in the field. And so we have had deployments in a number of countries where we literally go in. I stand side by side with healthcare workers trying to understand what it's like for them to be using these. How can we better improve the product? What works and what doesn't? And so the solar suitcase itself has actually evolved quite a bit since the first iteration. We also feel that research is important, both research on the performance of the suitcase in the field and research on what kind of impact this is having on healthcare. And we also feel education is extremely important, both education in terms of working with healthcare workers to understand how to use solar electricity and how to work with local people to become the installers themselves. And so we try and build local capacity. And I have other educational programs I can discuss afterwards with anyone interested. And finally, we're creating partnerships with NGOs and governments that are trying to bring solar lighting to health facilities, and also partnerships with groups that are helping to fund us to help deliver these solutions to other types of humanitarian organizations, including schools and orphanages, and looking for other types of mobile applications. The solar suitcase itself is considered a complete unit right now. We have lights that are extremely durable that you can literally throw across a room or dunk in water and they won't break. And that came because we saw what it was like for people trying to use them in some of the Haiti tent cities where water was a huge problem and people might drop things. We also have capacities to expand the solar suitcase by adding batteries and additional solar panels. We can charge laptops so people can have connectivity. We power other devices like a fetal Doppler, and we're actually looking at a whole suite of devices that would eventually be able to work off of this mobile solar platform. The solar suitcase itself can become a permanently mounted cabinet. And so you can either use it as you go from site to site or attach it to a wall and install it for permanent use. We did a project about a year ago with World Health Organization in Liberia where we lit up 20 clinics, and we're trying to understand the impact on maternal health care in those settings. In Nigeria, we've gotten support from the MacArthur Foundation and the Blum Center for Developing Economies, where we're studying the impact of about 40 solar suitcases in northern Nigeria. We had thought initially that we would just be using these in clinics, but the hospitals came to us begging to have these as well because so many power outages were occurring that they felt if they had the suitcases, they would be able to conduct surgeries at night and not send people away to additional hospitals. So we actually are deploying these in hospitals as well as in clinics. And in Uganda very recently, we did a deployment of 20 solar suitcases that led the permanent secretary of Uganda to say, I want these in as many clinics as we can possibly get them, because people immediately grasped the tangible difference that having reliable light and electricity can make. I mentioned that we have a teaching program. We definitely try and build local capacity in the use of solar suitcases, but we also want to train local people themselves to become the teachers. And so we've been having workers in Nigeria and Sierra Leone translating our educational programs, and they are the ones themselves who are now training others in these countries. Last month, I was in Sierra Leone. I was begged by the woman on the right, a midwife named Aisha Durami, to come to her country at a point when I said, look, I don't have the bandwidth to go to another country right now. But she convinced us to come, and we brought 7 solar suitcases there, and literally villagers would come out singing and dancing to celebrate the fact they would have light in their clinics, making up songs like, now we have light, our people can be treated, thank you, oh, bless you for coming. We conducted classes, as I described, in other settings. And if you are here in the audience, you can see that it isn't just the health workers who benefited from the class, but there were children and adults that were so curious that would peek through windows and try and be part of this as well. And we always tried to, again, impart the knowledge of how to safely install solar. And we found that entire villages would get to be part of these deployments. The Ministry of Health in Sierra Leone is now asking us to bring solar suitcases to more than 1,000 facilities that are there. In fact, they have 1,140, and they said that number of solar suitcases would literally electrify every primary healthcare facility in their country. And so we're at a real inflection point and really hoping to find a way to make that dream of theirs come true. We're also continuing to work with other partners on how to use very low energy medical devices that could really supplement the functions of the solar suitcase. They now come with fetal monitors, but we're interested in looking at ultrasound. And we're also looking at larger things like blood bank refrigeration, which you can see is actually now being powered by solar suitcases with larger batteries and larger solar panels. In addition to these larger installations and projects, we still are very interested in helping individual clinics. And I'm just completely moved by stories we've heard from one doctor in the DR Congo, Jacques Sebisaho, who begged us for a solar suitcase in November. We sent it to him in New York and literally trained him by Skype on how to use it. The day that he brought this to his clinic in an island called Ijwi in the DR Congo, there was an outbreak of cholera. And he said that that solar suitcase was put to use night and day for the next month, where he was treating as many as 15 patients at a time. There were so many patients they had to create an outdoor clinic using mats they put on the grass. And they used the solar suitcase to go from patient to patient, monitoring how they were doing, reading the bottles of medication to see what they were giving, starting IVs, and administering medication. He told us for the first time in his life, they saved every mother, father, and child suffering from cholera in that village. And he said they usually lose about 50% of their patients. I just got a letter from him several days ago. This is now several months later, and I want to read you some of it. The solar suitcase has completely transformed our community. It's the only light we've been using. People are pouring into the clinic night and days. In fact, it's now become the main meeting place for the northern part of Ijwi. A few days ago, the Minister of Health came. Initially, we had only been covering 3 villages, but now he says we're allowed to cover 12 villages because people are coming to us from all over the island. We've observed this trend after we brought the solar suitcase. Our staff morale increased and the community's trust grew, according to members of the community. We are witnessing what life can do in a community and how it can save lives in communities where night means death. So in closing, I just want to reflect for a moment on what does it mean to save the life of a woman? What does it mean to save the life of one mother? Certainly it means that that woman herself gets to have a full life, a productive life in society, and get to watch her own children grow. But saving a life in the situations and the areas in which we work means so much more. It means that her baby is more likely to survive infancy. It means that her children are more likely to go to school and less likely to be malnourished. It means her husband is more likely to be a productive member of society. In fact, saving the life of a woman is saving the life of a family and in many ways saving the fabric of a community. We're hoping in the next 4 years to bring 10,000 solar suitcases to clinics around the world. And even if these clinics only do 200 deliveries a year, which is low for a lot of them, we'll be touching the lives of 2 million mothers and babies and their families. We certainly could not do this without many, many partnerships. We're still a small organization. And we're very, very grateful for the funding that we've received, for the connections we've made with NGOs and governments that have really allowed us to extend our reach. I want to thank all of you for letting me describe a little bit of this journey. I also just want to close by saying, as an obstetrician, I know that light alone cannot save lives. It's just a really essential ingredient, and it's really hard to perform life-saving care if you don't have light and power. And I thank all of you for your attention.
Hi, everyone. Laura, thanks so much. That was really inspiring. You guys are just saving so many lives around the world, so it's just very, very cool what you guys are doing. And we just want to thank you for that. Thanks also to the Commonwealth Club for bringing us together. We were chatting a bit before the event, and I think we're thinking of partnership possibilities, so it's always fun to meet new partners. So I just wanted to kind of build on Laura's description of what it's like for families without electricity. And I'll zoom out. Instead of talking about kind of the individual perspective, I want to get you a sense of the scope of this issue globally. So basically, there's about 1 in 5 people in the world who don't have any access to electricity. And, you know, I'd be curious to hear from you, like, in India, how many people do you think don't have electricity? What do people think? How many millions? Yeah, there you go. 500 million people in India without electricity. It's a huge number. In other parts of Africa, Africa in total, it's about another 500, 600 million people. Other parts of the world, another 500 million people. So a huge number of people don't have electricity. And then there's about another 1 billion people who have an electric connection, but it's highly unreliable. So effectively, they're not getting electricity most of the time. And this has a lot of negative effects. But one such one of the main problems is in lighting, as Laura has described. And you know, kerosene lighting for a home is a really bad source of light. It's polluting. I don't know if any of you have burned a kerosene lamp before, but it's really smoky. And it's not like the kind of kerosene you might get here. Usually kerosene in India and Africa, it's adulterated. It's really smoky. It's polluting. It's not nice stuff. Horrible for health clinics, but also terrible for a household. Really hard to study by, hard to read by, hard to do anything, any activities by. So you're getting this very dim source of light. And on top of that, you're paying a lot of money for it. These households end up spending 10 to 20% of their income to buy kerosene for light. It's huge amounts of money. And about $38 billion is spent every year globally on kerosene for lighting. So it's a huge amount of money that's being spent from families who are making $1 or $2 a day. In addition to all that, it's expensive, it's dim and dangerous, and you know, a lot of kids get burned by kerosene lamps every year. Millions of kids are burned or die from kerosene fires. And kerosene emits a lot of CO2. So on top of all this, it actually contributes to greenhouse, to global warming and greenhouse gas emissions. So just to give you a sense, one kerosene lamp, if I use it regularly every day for a few hours a day for about 5 years, that emits about a ton of CO2, which is like driving an SUV from San Francisco to New York. So this overall is just a bad solution for lighting. You know, basically, I just want to give you a little bit of a story of how we started. My co-founder, Sam Goldman, was in Peace Corps in rural Benin, which is a small country in West Africa. He was about 10 kilometers from the border of Nigeria. And he was living in a village out there, and he was using kerosene lamp himself. And one day, his neighbor's kid was burned in a kerosene fire. Basically, he was lighting the kerosene lamp, tipped it over, got engulfed in flames. He survived, but he essentially had to lie in a mat for 6 months, was disfigured, and was just in horrible pain. And, you know, Sam, after he was looking into technologies of LEDs and solar panels, you know, a lot of people have been talking about these types of technologies replacing kerosene lamps in developing countries, but these technologies were not getting to these people. And Sam just felt like, you know, it's a 21st century. This is ridiculous. Why is 1/5 of the world still using kerosene lamps, this horrible source of lighting, when there are technologies available that are much, much better? So that brought him to business school at Stanford, where I met him. And just a real quick background on myself. I have an engineering background, and I started up a couple of companies in the Bay Area that were technology-based. But sort of while I was doing that, I was also doing volunteer work for NGOs. I had a chance to travel with my wife to Malawi to work with HIV/AIDS patients. And that stuff really was deeply meaningful to me and fulfilling. But at the same time, I felt like I was more of a technology guy and a startup guy. And that's where that's where my skills were. And I wanted to figure out how to bring those things together to leverage business and technology to address big problems in the world, especially in developing countries. So that's what attracted me to some of the stuff happening at Stanford. There was a lot of buzz at that time happening around social enterprise, and the Stanford Design School had this program called Design for Extreme Affordability. So Sam and I were both really drawn to that. And basically, it was this interdisciplinary course that pulled MBAs and engineers and people from the education department all over to try and work on a product design approach to solving some of these big problems at the base of the pyramid. So for people who make $1, $2 a day. So that's where Sam and I got drawn together. And we really learned from some of the best product designers in the world, you know, how to use a really customer-centric design approach to design really great products. So instead of using that design thinking, which is typically applied for products for the richest 5% of the world, why not use that same kind of thinking for applying for technologies that can really benefit people in developing markets? So that was a really exciting concept for me and Sam. And we got to spend a bunch of time. We took a couple trips out to Myanmar or Burma, which Laura mentioned a little earlier, to visit families. We were working with a partner out there who was doing distribution of irrigation equipment. And they wanted to figure out what other products can we sell through our channel. And they're really interested in energy. And we were also very interested in energy products. And we took some prototypes out to the field. We spent a lot of time with customers in villages making less than $1 a day who were burning kerosene for light and did not like using that solution. They wanted alternatives. And we just spent a lot of time really designing the products with our customers and trying, you know, this variation and that variation, and just trying to optimize the design to have something really exciting and really great for our end customers. And we started to see, as we were refining the products, that all sorts of crazy things started happening in the villages when we came back to get our prototypes. So we would come back to the village, and then the light was confiscated from the household by the police. And then we wanted to find out why. We go to the police station, and it turns out they're using the light themselves in the police station because they thought it was really cool. We go to a village, and we met a brick maker. And actually, this was something that really inspired us to really launch this. Her name was Mia, and she was making bricks every day. And essentially, the way it worked, she and her five kids, they would make the bricks at night. They actually couldn't afford kerosene, so they bought diesel, which is even worse and more smoky and more dim, but it's a little cheaper than kerosene. But they would burn diesel at night and use that to make the bricks, and then they would leave them to dry in the sun. She made less than $1 a day of income. And we let her try this light out and came back a couple weeks later. And we came back, she literally cried because the light had just totally transformed her and her family's life. And she had saved up money to buy the prototype. And when we saw that, we just realized, gosh, there is a market that is not being addressed. There are real needs here. The businesses, they don't see this as a real market. And these technologies are not reaching people. And people are willing to pay for it because they're already paying for something much worse. And we can offer them alternatives that will pay for themselves very fast and enable them to get free from this whole kerosene dependence. So that's what really got us started. We from there, we started developing a business plan. We started entering competitions and just really tried to refine the business model to figure out how to scale this thing. And by the time we graduated, we got a little bit of seed money to get started. And we decided to take the plunge and try to make it happen. So Sam moved out to India to figure out sales and marketing. And I moved to China to figure out operations and product development. And we were, then off we went. It was a pretty, we didn't quite know what we were getting ourselves into at that point. Very optimistic and idealistic. And, you know, our goal, we set a goal for 100 million people impacted by 2020. And, you know, went from there. And basically, we developed some really cool products that, again, with this very customer-centered design approach. And I've laid out a few here, which I'll describe if in case I'm being listened to on the radio. Basically, this is our, it's basically a solar study light. And it's a small, compact product, fits in my hand. You can leave it out in the sun to charge all day. And then you get 4 hours of light. And this is enough to read by, to study by, really designed with kids in mind. And this retails for about $8 in the market. So it sounds like it's a good price, and it is a good price, but for a family that makes $1 a day, this is a lot of money. But these families are spending $5, $6 a month on kerosene. So if you think about it, after 6 weeks, the product pays for itself, and then they don't have to buy kerosene anymore. So it's actually quite a good investment for these families. Then we have another one that's like a kerosene lantern, you know, in terms of the form factor, but it looks kind of modern and hip. And basically, you leave it out in the sun to charge, and you get 8 hours of light at night on the low setting and 4 hours on the high setting. And this one sort of is designed to illuminate a room. And then finally, we have another one, which has an external panel and gives 100 hours of light on this low setting, and then 12 hours of light on the low and 4 hours on high. And in addition to just providing light, it also charges a phone, because this is actually a really big need also, which I don't have time to get into in detail, but you know, families with mobile phones in these areas have to spend a lot of money just to keep their phone charged. So mobile charging is a huge need in a lot of these villages, often second, you know, right after a light. So that's a big need we're trying to address as well. So we developed these cool products, and with our optimism, we felt like, okay, we have great products at great prices. These things should just take off. Turns out it's not actually that simple in these markets because distribution and marketing is really challenging. You can have a product with an amazing price point, amazing quality, with the right warranty, everything, but it doesn't mean it's going to sell. There aren't exactly Best Buys and Walmarts out in rural India and rural Africa. And typically, rural families without electricity are not the ones to first adopt a new technology. So they want to usually wait, see what happens in the cities, see what happens with their neighbors, make sure the technology works before they go out and invest themselves. The problem is that doesn't quite work when we're trying to design a product that works really well for people without electricity, but not so well for the urban areas. So it's pretty challenging on the marketing side to actually get these things to scale. Distribution is also really tough because there's not, as I said, a lot of existing retail shops for these types of electronics products. So you have to really find the right type of distribution network that reaches these families, but also that can engage them in demonstrating the product, and it's not just sitting on the shelf. Because if you put this product on the shelf in a rural kiosk or a little store, it's not going to sell. It's not going to sell unless they're explained what the product is, they have confidence on the warranty, and all sorts of things need to happen before these products actually move. So, you know, we've really been applying over the last few years a lot of our product design innovation thinking. Of course, we do that in the products, but much more so now we apply that to how to figure out distribution and marketing, which is really the big challenge for getting these types of technologies to scale. So, you know, we've been really fine-tuning this. And just to give you an idea also of how differently you have to think with marketing, I mean, we did a bunch of research. I was in Tanzania a couple years ago doing market research with our with some rural families and putting together like just some visual kind of advertisements or marketing in front of them to explain kind of the benefits of the product. And we had this cartoon that we thought was really brilliant in explaining it. And one of the images in the cartoon was this family, and it just showed them sort of from the waist up. And their reaction was, oh my goodness, what's happened to their legs? Because the way they think, it's very literal. They're not used to the kind of abstraction that we take for granted here because of what we're exposed to growing up. So a lot of the things we would take for granted kind of in our mindset isn't necessarily applicable when you're doing marketing in these rural areas. So you really have to design the marketing and the distribution channels in a way that actually works to get these products to sell through. And what we found really works in getting connected with getting these products adopted in villages is really targeting two groups. One is entrepreneurs. We find that sort of the entrepreneurs in a village are ones who immediately can understand the benefit. And we often see that when people get these lights, not only do they save money, and not only does the health improve and all these other great things, but actually families can make more money when they have these products, and especially the entrepreneurs in a village. And we've just seen this over and over again. You know, if you take these products and light up a little kiosk, they can stay open for more hours at night, and they can sell more. Or if they have a tailoring business, they can sew more things at night so they can sell more the next day. And one kind of example that sticks out for me in my head, we were working in this village in India called New Karinga, and these families essentially got offered the lights on financing. So they were able to purchase them by paying a few dollars a week, about as much as they were paying for kerosene. And these families ended up starting a little business making little banana leaf plates and then selling them in the market. And they ended up increasing their income by 50% with this new business. And as a result, the entire village adopted this product. And I had have a picture of this village, which is just this amazing picture of every single household lit up with solar lights. So that's one group that we find that if we can get them engaged, it can really set off a spark that goes to the whole village. The other one is really students. And families really will invest a lot in their children's education. Education is highly valued in all of these markets. And, you know, if people feel like they can get something to their kids that are going to give them more opportunity to study and to get better grades, that's a really effective way of getting these technologies in different homes. And what we've seen is there's a huge educational impact when these lights go into a household. We recently did a pilot in northern India with a partner who works with schools and got to get these lights out to a bunch of 10th standard students, so about 1,000 10th standard students. They got to take home the lights during exam season, try them out, and basically use them during the exam time. And afterwards, the people who were organizing the pilot came back and said, if you want, you can keep the light. They told the family, and they cost $8. And as a result, all these really interesting things happened. One was that the study time average at night doubled. So you had kids studying twice as long at night, from 1 to 2 hours a night, from to 2 to 4 hours a night. Pass rates of the exam also doubled. So the pass rates of this little, we did this in a few schools, and those schools all of a sudden had this giant spike in pass rates. Also 80%, more than 80% of these families decided to buy the product, which is a pretty amazing sell-through rate for base of the pyramid families. So, you know, we know that families are willing to spend on education, and that's a really great way to get these types of technologies seeded into a community. And once they see the benefits of it, then you can start spreading with other types of products that might be a little more expensive and more offer more different values. So I guess I just want to end with explaining where we are today. So we've sold now about 1.3 million lights, a little over that amount, in about 40 countries. We're selling about 100,000 lights a month now, which has been really exciting. We used to really hit our heads against the wall to try to sell 1,000 lights a month. So to get to this level has been really fun. You know, we know that when one of these lights gets into a household, it impacts about 5 or 6 people. So today we're impacting, you know, over 6 million people with our products. So we're well on our way to the 100 million mark by 2020, which is exciting. And, you know, but that said, there's still 1.5 billion people without electricity and are still using kerosene. So really, these numbers that we've reached so far are just really tiny. The market penetration of these products, it's less than 1%. So there's still a very long way to go. And a lot more need for innovation and distribution and marketing, all these kinds of things. We still haven't really cracked it. We're just really at the tip of the iceberg. So I'll end it there and we'll open it up for questions.
We want to thank Ned Tosin and Dr. Laura Satchel for their enlightening presentation this evening. I want to remind our listening audience that we are listening to a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and it is called Lighting Up Lives with Solar Power, and you're definitely doing that. I'm Karen Kiefer, your chair for this evening program, and I'll open it up to questions now.
Ned, you explained some of the pitfalls you had with the challenging marketing and distribution. How was it on your end, Laura? Did you also had some pitfalls, or were your expectation was totally different as the acceptance, or as you know, as the perception in the villages?
It is a huge challenge. And we have a very different model because we are a nonprofit organization.
And so we rely on grants and donations and foundations for this. So in our case, at this point, none of the health facilities with which we work would ever be able to afford these. They are facilities that struggle for Band-Aids and for basic medication. So we really are looking to partner with larger institutions, ministries of health, aid organizations, as I mentioned, foundations. The receptivity is huge, and you know, we also bring some of these types of products with us and give them out. And everybody, once they see them, there's no turning back. They just want them. It's like...
Is it 100% donated, or do they pay a portion of it? Because, I mean, if everything is always comes for free, you know, there's no value to it. So
it's a really good point. The question was about whether or not people will value something if they get them for free. We have found that health workers who struggle in darkness really do seem to value it. That being said, we think long-term it would be really good to think of ways that the health facilities and the health workers themselves do create buy-in. Right now, so much of what we're doing is highly researched that we actually have the buy-in be that they fill out a lot of forms and they help us by providing the feedback, and that's the level of buy-in. I will mention that a while ago we brought, maybe a couple years ago, I brought some small light products like the D-Light. In fact, it was one of the early D-Light. People were lining up to buy them. I mean, people will buy the personal items. It's a little harder in a publicly funded clinic to expect the healthcare workers to take money out of their pockets. They do sometimes take money out of their pockets to help people get medication to prevent a death, but to provide a solar electric system, it's a little bit of a different order of magnitude. But your points are very well taken.
Hi, has WeCare considered dental applications for your suitcase?
Dental applications. I think we may have had some requests, actually, from dentists. Can you remember, Hal? Have we had any? I feel like it's come up.
Could you say more about what you mean by dental?
Well, there's a lot of mobile clinic now throughout the world. I spent some time in Malawi, as a matter of fact. And it would be nice to have a mobile unit, a solar system powering a small compressor to get air driven hand pieces, maybe a small suction device.
Yeah, so I think we keep finding different potential applications. We've had people wanting oxygen concentrators for infants, infant warming pads for babies, suction machines for all sorts of reasons, and we actually are partnering with other institutions. For example, Villanova University is creating a low-power suction device to help us for surgical applications and for newborns needing resuscitation. Probably work extremely well as well for a dental application. And Lawrence Berkeley National Lab is now starting a program to develop an institute for globally transformative technologies, and they're also talking to us, and we're developing a partnership to come up with other devices that, again, could work in the developing world. And the key here is to find ones that can be very highly efficient to utilize much less energy than traditional devices that are currently being manufactured. So we're trying to shift the conversation because we think if we can really get the power requirements down, we can open up so many more medical supplies and equipment to facilities right now that are really in such rural areas they will never get the power grid to go them and the, to go there. And the only way to really try and bring these clinics to the 21st century is to really reimagine what health equipment, what medical equipment would look like if you had a very limited power budget. And we are trying to shift that conversation.
Hi, my name is Victor. One question that I have is that what were the challenges that you faced bringing these products into the countries? You talked about police confiscating these products and bringing them. Some people found it funny, but I didn't. And that's kind of where my question is geared. Corruption, for example, people with authority taking advantage of the people with no money, no authority. I'm from South America and kind of seen this firsthand.
Sure. Yeah, it's something that we honestly try to avoid working with the governments directly, and we just try to work through distribution partners that we really trust and who have a good brand in the countries that can help us facilitate getting products in. We have offices ourselves in India, in Nairobi, and you know, we have an absolute policy of we won't pay any bribery, won't do anything unethical, and you have to really set a very high standard as a company working in this space because you're right, it is very serious, actually, and it's something that to do business in a lot of these countries, it's often expected that you'll pay bribes or do other things, and you just have to say absolutely not. And you know, at times that's prevented us from getting big deals, and it's fine, and we just move on. And like I said, really, a way we try to get around it is by working with respected partners in the countries who have good reputations, who have figured out distribution, who don't pay bribes, and those typically exist in a lot of countries. So we really have to find those partners and work with them, and just have a very clear policy with all of our staff on the ground and all of our partners that we have a no tolerance policy on any corruption. So that's how we think about it.
I would just add to that, because I've mentioned already that we do work with governments, but we actually work in concert with other partners, exactly as Ned was saying. I used to say at the beginning that it was the stealth solar suitcase. We tried to go under the radar of the government, and we would literally directly bring them to facilities a lot of times without the government even knowing. But then we realized for us to scale, we really have to be partnering with the organizations that are really responsible for public good. But by having other partners that are helping us with implementation, that's really how we can make sure our product gets to where it needs to go and that it's being monitored and that we do follow-up that's appropriate to make sure things are being used appropriately.
Hi. Laura, one of the great things about this story is that maternal mortality, which often people think of as sort of an intractable problem, actually you have a solution to it. I think there's a Millennium Development Goal to reduce maternal mortality. I think we've made some actual decent progress towards that. So I'm wondering, sort of, in the places where maternal mortality has been reduced, you know, what is working, and is electricity and light part of that solution in the places where it is actually going down?
So the question was about the Millennial Development Goals, and actually by 2015, one of the Millennial Development Goals is to lower maternal mortality by 75% by the year 2015. And there are countries that have been making progress. They tend to be countries that actually do have better electricity and where a lot of the very good interventions, things like medications and protocols and health workers, those interventions have the electricity that they need to be enacted. And so I feel like in the countries where there is not reliable electricity, we're really not leveraging those investments in the same way. And so one of the things on our bandwagon is we really want people to understand that you're not completely helping a health system if you're giving them a bunch of tools but then preventing them from really utilizing those tools if you don't have light or you don't even have communication, like Ned was mentioning. I didn't really emphasize it in my talk either, but a lot of these health facilities, there's tiers of different health systems, and so people in some of the more primary frontline tiers need to refer patients to other tiers. That requires a phone to call for an ambulance. If you don't have a phone system, you've just cut off the ability to save that woman's life who needs to get to a hospital that can do a C-section, for example.
I'd like to ask Ned if local entrepreneurs, seeing the value of this light, have begun to offer competitive or at least similar devices in the local markets.
Yeah, you know, we've seen some competitors coming into play. I think it's a little difficult to make this type of product locally. I see it analogous to a mobile phone, honestly, where you don't see a lot of local players making mobile phones, but you do see kind of the cheap knockoffs coming into the market. So I think that's more of what we've seen. There are some other companies making good quality products, but the majority of things coming into this market right now are very low quality solar lighting products, often cheap, but maybe they'll survive for a few weeks and then they'll break. So what happens is now when we go to a village and introduce these technologies, instead of it being totally new, people say, oh, yeah, we've seen this before. This type of technology doesn't work because we bought these before and they've broken. So that actually creates some more hurdles for us. I think, you know, competition in the perspective of really high quality stuff that's helping, honestly, that just helps build the market. And like I said, the penetration is so low at this point, we're not really focused on fighting against that at all. I mean, our main competitor right now is still kerosene, for sure. So we haven't seen a lot of local entrepreneurs making products that are at scale, but certainly local entrepreneurs are figuring out how to distribute, how to do the marketing. And I think that's where you see a lot more of that entrepreneurial energy. And there's quite a lot of local entrepreneurs that work with our products, resell them in their communities, and actually make a pretty good living off of it. We see, I mean, literally thousands of these people are out there reselling our products in villages. It's pretty fun to see.
This question for Laura. You mentioned that in the health facilities, the medical facilities, and the clinics cannot, in many cases, cannot afford the product. But do you see, is there, if any, areas where you are looking at selling the product?
There are two different ways I can answer that. One is that there are private clinics and hospitals, and those clinics that do have money tend to be very interested in purchasing it, so that's one area of doing sales. But when we're also looking at trying to scale something to a region, we're really interested in working with health systems. And so we would definitely love to work with ministries of health that can afford this. For example, in Nigeria, it's actually a country that has a fair amount of endowment. The money just doesn't really trickle down to those in need. So that would be a country that we might be able to find purchasers. In a lot of the countries we work, however, the Ministry of Health budget is just a fraction of what it should be to even provide the most basic services for people. And so as much as they would love to have the money, I mean, in Sierra Leone, they just didn't want me to leave. They just said, please stay, bring these. But, you know, they open their books. They just don't have a lot of money for even basic services. So it really requires partnerships. Very often in many of these countries in which we choose to work, it's really the aid organizations that I think are ultimately going to be our biggest allies.
I'm an engineer, not a marketing person, but it strikes me that this might be the kind of distribution that people use for multi-level marketing. I was visiting Mongolia, and there was a Nu Skin store there, for crying out loud, mm-hmm. selling cosmetics. So why couldn't that kind of multi-level structure, with a lot of local activity, they really know their neighborhood, et cetera, and price might go up a bit, but would that push the product? Have you ever tried something like that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting concept. We've been prototyping with it, and we've been prototyping with actually a lot of different types of marketing methods to figure out, you know, how expensive is the marketing method versus, you know, how does it impact the price? How does it impact penetration? It's honestly can be quite different by country. And what we've really seen works is sort of, it's similar to the multi-level marketing strategy, but it's essentially pairing up local entrepreneurs and connecting them with the outlets where the lights are being sold, and then having them go out to the community to drive sales to that outlet. And we find that works pretty well. And we do a lot of training and equipping of these salespeople to help sell the lights in their community, because as I was mentioning before, if the lights just sit on the shelf, they won't sell. They really require demonstration, trial, all those sorts of things. And once people get it and they see that concept, then people love it. I mean, they really go, it really transforms their whole household. It's a big deal. But you have to get over that initial barrier. And then once you do that with enough households in a village, then word of mouth starts spreading. But one household isn't enough to spread word of mouth. You have to get to a certain level. People tend to be a little shy if they're the only one in the village with something new. So you have to get a certain percentage before people start talking about it. But that's a really good question. You know, we're always looking at new models of marketing because, you know, that's really, if we can start cracking that, the scale just gets bigger and bigger. Yeah, right? Yeah, absolutely.
Hi. So you mentioned a warranty and you mentioned sort of follow-up on the product. So I'm curious just to hear from both of you about what happens when your products break.
I can go first. Ours is really simple. We have a year warranty on the products, and if anything happens, they can go back to where they bought the product and get a replacement, and then we replace it to the distributor. So it's actually quite simple in our case. There's not, we don't do servicing or repairs. They're so simple of a product that, you know, if anything goes wrong, we'll just replace it.
Ours is similar in that we replace products that break, but we also have created by design something that does have parts that can be replaced. And as we build capacity in these countries, we can actually teach people how to swap out a component that wouldn't function well. One of the components, for example, is something called a charge controller. It regulates how much electricity comes from a solar panel. It's actually not very difficult to do, and we've had sometimes people change these in about 10 minutes. So that can happen. That's called field serviceable rather than field replaceable. But typically in large installations, we do actually provide extra solar suitcases to our partner organization. So if there was a problem, they could be easily replaced. And then we're always eager to learn what could have gone wrong. And luckily, we haven't had too many examples. But we do ask for them to come back to the state so that we can learn from that and see if there's something we can do to improve the design.
What is the approximate cost of the solar suitcase?
The solar suitcase that comes with a number of things, including lighting and phone charging and additional battery chargers and smaller batteries and headlamps, et cetera, that's about $14.95. And We expect that the lifespan will be at least 10 years. Some of the parts of it should actually last for 20 years. And so when you look at the total lifetime and including things like replacing batteries, which will eventually need to be replaced, it really comes out to be about 68 cents a day.
I'm afraid we have time for only one last question.
Laura and Ned, thanks for your efforts and sharing your story. Amazing stuff. Question for Ned. You hinted at it earlier in terms of getting financing for the lighting. Do you work with, like, microfinance organizations, who've lent things out to entrepreneurs and to kind of get their product out there to provide financing all in, like, one swoop?
Yeah, so that's – financing is really sort of the it's quite magical if you can get it to work, because if you can get people to pay less than they pay for kerosene for these lights, essentially you get 100% adoption. It's quite amazing. But the problem is microfinance organizations typically want to do $200, $300 loans. They don't want to do an $8 loan. That's not very interesting. It's very hard to be profitable on that for them. So we've done financing, I would say at small scales and local scales, either with MFIs who are willing to take the effort on to do it or who can add it on to existing loans. We've worked also with organizations that can provide credit or essentially allow people to pay in installments. But those are sort of some special distribution channels that are definitely not available everywhere. The more we can make financing available, the better it is. But it's hard to do for these types of price points, for these types of products.
Well, we want to certainly thank Laura Stachel and Ned Tosin for their incredible, fantastic presentation this evening. Thank you. So we wish you good fortune in your continuing to make this world a far better place. Thank you both. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.